950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome out into the Wednesday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. And you've probably heard these ads running throughout the day, but we are having a presidential debate watching party coming up on Wednesday. Actually, make that Tuesday, September 29th, as that will be at Crooner's Supper Club off Moore Lake and Highway 65 in the metro area. They've been running outdoor concerts all summer long safely, so we'll have plenty of precautions that will be taken, including having socially distanced tables, and we'd love to see you out there to watch that presidential debate. That is Tuesday, September 29th. Order your tickets now over at am950radio.com. That's am950radio.com. Well, let's get to the news of today and talk about what's happening in Minnesota politics. And helping us do so is Patrick Kulikin. He is the editor-in-chief for the Minnesota Reformer. That website is minnesotareformer.com as he joins us now. Hey, Patrick, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
Hey, doing good myself. So I want to start off with what happened with the Minneapolis City Council yesterday as they held a rather contentious meeting as they were demanding some answers from the Minneapolis Police Department about, well, why more hasn't been done to stop the surge in violence we've been seeing over the summer. Now, you guys over at the Minnesota Reformer have been reporting about how police response times have been slowing pretty dramatically since the death of George Floyd. So talk a little bit about that and your reporting with what happened last night in Minneapolis.
Right. So our reporter, Dina Winter, filed a public records request to get response time from Minneapolis Police Department. And what that showed was that response times have slowed considerably since the death of George Floyd. And also police are making fewer, I guess we'd call proactive policing maneuvers, like they're not pulling over cars as much. And you, of course, depending on who you ask, you have a different answer as to why this is happening. Is it, as police say, an increase in violent crime, which we've seen in Minneapolis and in other large metros across the country, that is tying officers up for longer, and so therefore they can't get to the calls? Or is it a slowdown that's either coordinated and deliberate on the part of the union, or is it just sort of disorganized or not organized, but still a kind of work slowdown on the part of officers who are frustrated with how they perceive that they are being treated by the city council and the citizens, for that matter? It's a contentious issue, and it's very fraught and frightening for people who live, especially in certain neighborhoods, where they don't feel safe, either because they feel threatened by crime and with good reason, but they also feel that the police are not necessarily on their side. So it's a really difficult situation.
And there's been reports out of Minneapolis as well. In fact, several city council members have been bringing this up, that there's been cases where constituents have called the police for emergencies, and largely they've been told when they dial 911 that, well, the response times are a little bit slower and that you need to talk to your city council members as to why those response times are slowing. But I like something you wrote today in your piece over in the Minnesota Reformer in the newsletter, the daily newsletter that you send out, and you were talking about that, well, should we really expect anything different, especially given the actions of the city council and kind of their disorganized approach towards either abolishing or reforming the police department? And you use this analogy right here where you said, if Republicans said they were going to abolish public schools and reimagine something different, but then told educators that they still need to keep teaching children in the same way in the meantime, you would probably expect Republicans would shouldn't be surprised when teachers started, well, kind of dogging it in the classroom. And that is some pretty sound logic when you think about it, where it was a rather disorganized effort by the city council when they rolled out some of the police forms that they put through, where they didn't really have a number of constituencies on board. And what you're kind of arguing is that, well, we really shouldn't be surprised by what we're seeing with these slower police response times from the department.
Yeah, and I don't mean to excuse the behavior, right, if in fact the department is dogging it, nor do I mean to draw an analogy between teachers and cops. But I just think we have to consider, I mean, as you, every action has a reaction, and you just have to consider what the consequences are going to be when you're entering what's looking to be a tough summer with respect to violent crime, and then you go out and make this statement that you're going to end the Minneapolis Police Department and you're going to work with the community on a police-free future. You have to think about what the consequences of those statements are going to be with respect to the 800 sworn officers. And I don't know that they did think of that. Or if they did, I guess they thought, well, that the benefits of that June announcement outweighed the costs. So, but now you're left with a very difficult political situation where you have the Minneapolis City Council, after pledging to work with the community on a police-free future, asking the chief of police, I don't want to say begging, but pleading with him to do something about violent crime. And so you can imagine the reaction from the usual suspects is that, well, you know, that's really your problem. Because you're the ones who wanted a police-free future.
Well, I think another way to think about it, too, is that we're not talking about whether it's a good idea or not to abolish or reform the Minneapolis Police Department. I think what we're trying to bring up here is that, well, if you're going to go through some sort of major reform with how the policing system works in Minneapolis, you better have a good plan put together, because you're going to certainly have to expect that there's going to be blowback. And I think we're kind of seeing this right now with the slower response times from the Minneapolis police. So I think that's kind of the point you were making, or at least I'm kind of picking up too, where
and also, you know, if they didn't expect it, they should have, and they also should have been laying the groundwork with the Charter Commission and with the legislature. Mm-hmm. There's not much evidence of that either. So I just don't know that they had a plan.
Well, let's move on to another topic here, Patrick, and we talk about this every week, but I got to keep bringing it up because this story with the Jim Hagedorn office keeps getting crazier and crazier. Now, just some background in case you're new to this and haven't been following along. Basically, the office of Jim Hagedorn, 1st Congressional District Congressman, spent roughly $450,000 on Frank mail to vendors that included a member of Hagedorn's own staff and his brother of the now fired chief of staff. So, yeah, definitely some conflicts of interest, as they were basically spending public taxpayer money on political mailers, which is something you're not supposed to do when you're a congressperson. So the latest development we have now, Patrick, as you guys are reporting on, is that a lawyer with ties to the DFL was contacted, or at least it appears they had contacts with Dan Feehan's campaign. He is the Democratic opponent of Jim Hagedorn, and it looks like we have an ethics complaint that has been filed against the Jim Hagedorn office, correct?
That's right. So you can file an ethics complaint with something called the Office of Congressional Ethics, and they can decide whether or not to investigate what you have filed to them and pass it on to the House Ethics Committee. The reality is, I suspect that the Office of Congressional Ethics was already looking into this because of all the reporting on it, including by the reformer, and it's just ripe for some investigation. It's already cost Jim Hagedorn, his chief of staff, his job, and the whole situation looks pretty untoward when you're spending all this taxpayer money on a company, a couple companies that frankly seem like kind of fly-by-night companies. You paid them above market rates to send, gauzy mailers about yourself to your constituents. One of the companies is owned by a guy on your staff. Another company is owned by the brother of your chief of staff. So yeah, it certainly cries out for an investigation. The ethics complaint that you mentioned by the Green Espo lawyer, she actually kind of found something that we had missed, and that is that we're getting a little deep in the weeds, but I find it really interesting. One of the companies they were paying that was owned by two people. One is a guy named John Sample who works for Hagedorn, and then another woman. The woman died late last year, and Hagedorn says, and his lawyer says anyway, that the work ended with that company because the woman died and she was no longer able to do it. But the problem is that they continued to pay the company. So it's not clear what the taxpayers were getting in exchange. Mm-hmm. So that was a really important nugget that that is out of this ethics complaint.
Yeah, and I read through that piece over in MinnesotaReformer.com, yeah, the owner of this company died in December of 2019, but it looks like this firm was still being paid through April of 2020 for work that was being done in 2020, even though this company didn't exist. And I think this is key to point out because, yeah, if a congressional person is going to waste a bunch of money, I mean, fine, go ahead if that's their own money. But the key part is this is public taxpayer money that's being spent to this firm, which doesn't appear to exist anymore. And that's the bigger issue right there. If someone's going to mismanage their finances, more power to them. It's the fact that it's taxpayer money that's really caught the ire of a lot of people in the 1st Congressional District.
Yeah, and also bizarre is that the guy who works for the congressional office, his name is John Sample, and he has this, a graphic design printing firm, which he's moonlighting with. For whatever reason, why would he not have been fired? That's another question that comes up. Hagedorn went ahead and fired the chief of staff, Peter Sue, when some of this questionable spending came up. But this guy, John Sample, for whatever reason, is apparently so valuable to the American public and the people of the 1st District that he's not been let go. It's odd, to say the least.
So what's going to happen next with this ethics complaint? I saw you guys writing over at MinnesotaReformer.com. We're probably not going to see any resolution to this ethics complaint before the election, so this does sound like something that will probably drag out for several months.
Yeah, I mean, now it goes into that labyrinthine bureaucratic process of house ethics, and defend themselves. Mm-hmm. They defend their fellow members very often. And it's also very opaque, so it's hard to know. But it's certainly would take a long time. Ultimately, this is going to be decided by the people of the 1st District.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so in November, you know, they're either going to say this bothers us, the way he's managed that office, he's got to go, or they're going to say they'll accept his argument that President Trump, who won that district by 15 points, by the way, in 2016, that he needs someone like Jim Hagedorn who stood behind him every step of the way.
And what's key, too, is that back in 2018, when Hagedorn was first elected, even though, as you brought up, it is a relatively heavy Trump district, Hagedorn was only elected by less than one percentage point. It was a very close race that he had with Dan Feehan back in 2018, and they're, of course, having a rematch here in 2020. So that'll certainly be an interesting race to watch. But at least from a political perspective, what I find really interesting about this race is that we're talking about a $500,000 of taxpayer money being spent on political mailers, and it's had a pretty big impact on the race for Jim Hagedorn, and it's just interesting to, for instance, compare that to some of the scandals we've seen from the Trump administration that have basically had no political impact, so it's just kind of interesting to compare these two guys, Hagedorn and Trump, where it doesn't appear that Hagedorn has quite that sort of a Teflon sort of feel that Donald Trump has, where he can weather all sorts of scandals that come his way.
Well, Trump said himself that he could be going down, he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, and his supporters wouldn't desert him. We're seeing that. We've seen that played out for 4 years.
Final topic for you here, Patrick, and I got to talk about what's been happening in the state legislature with the emergency session, which was recently called last week, as the relationship between Governor Tim Walz and Republican Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka has continued to deteriorate, if there even was a good relationship in the first place, as this comes after another commissioner within the Walz administration, that would be the Department of Commerce, Steve Kelly, he was fired back last week, and it's led to, well, more of an exchange of words between Walz and Gazelka. But again, thinking about this from the political perspective about what this could mean for the future, you bring up a fun, or depending on your perspective, not so fun scenario of having Governor Tim Walz in office in 2021 and 2022, but Republicans maintaining their majority in the state Senate, which could set up quite a dynamic since Gazelka very likely is going to be a gubernatorial candidate in 2022. So you can picture that scenario of Walz trying to negotiate with a Republican-controlled Senate while he's potentially running against the Republican Senate majority leader in 2024 or 2022 in the governor's race. That certainly sets up a pretty juicy political scenario in the future, but something that probably doesn't mean a whole lot's going to get done at the legislature.
Yeah, not a great governing scenario at all when you have two guys who are, even if not consciously, they're unconsciously thinking of every move they make and how it's going to affect their 2022 race. And it's not as if the state can be on autopilot right now. I think that the legislature next session is going to be the most consequential, certainly since I've arrived in 2014, probably the most consequential since the Great Recession. You're going to have a budget crisis, which and they're going to have to do work hard to try to prevent serious cuts to schools and social services, where it could require a tax increase because the state has to balance its budget. It's not like the federal government, which can just go and use deficit spending. And then we've also have, the pandemic. It's not like it's just going to magically end. So there's the effects of that. I mean, I think that there's going to be more calls for police reform. So there's a lot. And then there's redistricting as well when they are going to have to redraw legislative and congressional maps. So there's a lot to do next year, and we need to have a high-functioning legislature. So if the Republicans do keep the Senate, it certainly will be entertaining to watch. But as a Minnesotan, it certainly concerns me that we'll have a serious gridlock.
Yeah, pretty much expect what you've seen during the recent special sessions would likely continue next year if we have the same political dynamic of Governor Walz in the governor's mansion and Republicans still in control of the state Senate. All right, Patrick, got to let you go in just one second, but I do want to bring this up. You guys have some fundraising that's happening right now since, well, Minnesota Reformer relies on funding from the general public to a degree, and you guys are definitely trying to make sure people sign up and support Minnesota Reformer and the great work you guys do reporting on local Minnesota politics.
Appreciate that. Yeah, we rely on donations, and we're only 8 months old, but I think we've done some great reporting and commentary, and we just hope to keep doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find out more information over at MinnesotaReformer.com. That's MinnesotaReformer.com, as they do some great local journalism. We've been speaking with Patrick Kulikan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, for our usual Wednesday visit. Patrick, as always, appreciate the time today.
Thanks. See you next week.
Sounds good. We'll take a break and come on back with some more news up next here on FYI Politics.
Hi, this is Laura. 2020 has been marked by a virus, growing evidence of the climate crisis, a political uprising, and many of us are feeling unsettled. Together, we get by with a little help from our friends. Together, we find the resilience to meet the moment. Regenerative economics holds great promise for improved systems. Instead of a dog-eat-dog world, let's create a trust economy, one that honors the earth and sees the limitless value of each individual. When we buy from each other, we know each other. go to AM950radio.com and see the wonderful independent businesses AM950 relies on to exist. These businesses are more than advertisers. They are our friends. We all get by with a little help from our friends. Help us build the AM950 business ecosystem. If you know of a company, service, or product that belongs in the AM950 community, let me know. Laura at AM950radio.com, or you may also call the station, 952-946-8885. AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Hi, this is Paul Metz inviting you to listen to a great new episode on the Wallet Power Radio Hour this weekend on AM950. We feature one of Minnesota's greatest acoustic guitar players, Mr. Billy McLaughlin, and he's going to tell us about his battle with and his journey with dystonia, where he had to switch from playing guitar right-handed to left-handed. Try it sometime. The Wallet Power Radio Hour this weekend at 6 p.m. on AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Joe Biden debates the big orange buffoon coming up on Tuesday, September 29th, and you have a chance to watch it with us and other AM950 listeners at Crooner's Supper Club. Crooner's has an outdoor stage with a large TV screen and great sound. They've been doing socially distanced concerts all summer and work hard to make sure everyone is safe. So come watch the debate with us and hear Trump make cutting-edge arguments like this.
This is a tough hurricane. One of the wettest we've ever seen from the standpoint of water.
Doors open at 7:30 with the debate beginning at 8. Tickets are $25 and include one complimentary drink and one seat at a two-person socially distanced table. Space is very limited, though, because of safety, and when tickets are gone, there will not be more available. Tickets are pre-sale only at AM950radio.com. Again, that's AM950's Debate Watch Party, Tuesday, September 29th at Crooner's Supper Club off Moore Lake and Highway 65. Tickets and details at AM950radio.com.
God bless Minneapolis and God bless the United States.
Connections Radio Show is all about tapping into our hardwired hunger to connect. We examine meaningful connections to ourselves, our community, and the world around us. By opening the door to innovative insights by a wide variety of interesting guests, we'll make the connections to something bigger than ourselves. Join me, Lori Fitz, your host of Connections Radio Show, and together we'll make the connections. Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Auto Technical helps families in need of transportation with reconditioned vehicles. Here's Richard with Auto Technical.
I'll tell you, my wife told me when we first started, she says, "You're going to find this so rewarding." But when people come in and, oh, man, give me a second.
Take your time.
And you just find out how important transportation is. People sometimes break down in tears and can't stop.
Learn more at autotechnical.org.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, back on the Wednesday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. A reminder, coming up tonight at 5 o'clock, it is Pilot's Progressive Party, as joining Robert and Wendy is going to be Dr. Alita Borud, who is running for State Senate in District 26. They'll also be joined by Jenny Bjorgo, who will be talking about the Wall of Forgotten Natives, as still unbelievable. We're still talking about the Wall of Forgotten Natives, as homelessness is an issue not going away and something that, well, still hasn't been addressed in the city and the state, as unfortunately the Wall of Forgotten Natives is back. Got to do something about that, so we'll have more on that coming up with Pilot's Progressive Party. That will be tonight from 5 until 6 o'clock. Make sure you tune into that. Let's go to some local news today. Got some quick hitter stories to get to before we go to our next segment. And I want to start off with this. So the rumors continue that the MyPillow founder and owner and CEO, Mike Lindell, is seriously considering a run for Minnesota governor in 2022. Here's at least my take on this. So during our last interview in the previous segment, I was talking with Patrick Coolican about how we potentially could have Paul Gazelka running against Governor Tim Walz in 2022. Ultimately, what comes down to who will the Republican nominee be in 2022 for governor probably is going to hinge on who controls the state Senate. If Republicans do maintain control of the state Senate, very likely you're going to have Paul Gazelka as the Republican nominee in 2022. But if Republicans lose the majority, that certainly has the stock of Paul Gazelka take a hit, and that's what I think would open the door towards having Mike Lindell be the Republican nominee. Yeah, I know he's certainly a clown that doesn't really have any political background whatsoever, but the Republicans in Minnesota don't really have a deep bench for statewide candidates, so if the Republicans lose the state Senate, probably going to have Mike Lindell as that Republican nominee. Again, as I've brought up on previous shows, Republicans have not won a statewide office in Minnesota since 2006, and they don't exactly have a deep bench of candidates that are ready for statewide office, so watch for Mike Lindell in 2022 if Republicans do indeed lose the state Senate this fall. Over in the 3rd Congressional District, Kendall Qualls, who is the Republican nominee challenging Dean Phillips, he has released his first campaign ad of the season. The ad is titled Called, C-A-L-L-E-D, and it's backed by a six-figure ad buy, as the 30-second ad highlights Kendall's amazing life story. This is from their press release, by the way. His amazing life story of rising from the housing projects of Harlem, New York, and a trailer park in Oklahoma to be the first in his family to graduate from college, and now he is currently running against Dean Phillips in CD3. I mean, the guy certainly has an inspirational background, but no one had really heard of Kendall Qualls prior to 2020. And again, this goes back to what I was talking about just a second ago, how the Republicans in the state largely lack a bench of deep and well-funded and well-known candidates to challenge Democrats in different races around the state. And this is another example right here where Kendall Qualls just entered the race in 2020. People generally don't know a whole lot about this guy, which puts him at a disadvantage in what could be a competitive district, but very likely won't be, which not necessarily is a knock against Kendall Qualls. It's the fact that Republicans in the state just don't have a deep bench of candidates. So, yeah, we'll see these ads probably pop up on TV, but Phillips will likely remain a very heavy favorite to be reelected coming up this fall. Speaking of Dean Phillips, he is in the news as he has joined a group of 50 centrist lawmakers as they plan to present later today a $1.5 trillion package to prop up the coronavirus-ravaged economy, as they're trying to make a last-ditch attempt to broach a compromise in hopes of breaking the stalemate stimulus talks before the November election. So it's a bipartisan group of 50 House lawmakers, both Republicans and Democrats, and Phillips is among them. So basically what this proposed legislation does is try to find middle ground between Republicans and Democratic positions. As in the proposals, they include measures that, well, do enjoy bipartisan support, like reviving the popular Paycheck Protection Program for small businesses and having an additional direct check of $1,200 to individual taxpayers. Yay, another $1,200 check. By the way, in Canada, I think they sent out like four payments of $2,000. Here in the U.S., yeah, we just got one measly payment of $1,200. Among the other proposals that are included in this bipartisan legislation are more protections for workers and employers in regards to the coronavirus. The protections for employers probably aren't going to be popular among more progressive lawmakers, but the bulk of the proposed spending would fall somewhere in the middle of what both parties are trying to champion. So, yeah, I know there's a lot of progressive listeners right now who are rolling their eyes going, oh, here comes Dean Phillips again, Mr. Moderate, trying to compromise with the Republicans. But I think Dean Phillips, in a way, is a lot like Joe Biden. And I think about it in this sense. Joe Biden has always been in the center of the Democratic Party. So if we imagine the Democratic Party where you have your progressives on your left and you have your moderates towards the middle, Joe Biden has always been in the middle of the party, finding that middle ground between the centrists and the progressives. And he'll move with wherever the Democratic Party goes. So if the Democratic Party is as a whole more progressive than it used to be, Joe Biden will still be in the middle of the party. In fact, kind of leads to the point that Donald Trump is not necessarily wrong when he says Joe Biden is just a Trojan horse for the rest of the Democrats. He's not necessarily wrong in that regards because Biden generally will move with wherever the Democratic Party goes. And I think the same thing is true about Dean Phillips, who is our current rep in the 3rd District. So if you're someone who is kind of rolling their eyes thinking, oh, well, here we go, Dean Phillips trying to negotiate with extreme right-wing Republicans – Well, if you want to move Dean Phillips to the more progressive side of the aisle, then move the whole party in that direction. Again, I think Biden and Dean Phillips are kind of in the same boat in that they're always going to represent the middle of the Democratic Party. Not the moderate part of the party, but I mean the middle part of the party, where they're trying to find, well, that compromise ground between the progressive parts and the more moderate sections of the Democrats. So, at least my take on what's happening with Dean Phillips sponsoring some legislation, some bipartisan legislation to try to rescue a coronavirus package. Let's see. Got time for one more story. What should we hit up here? I actually want to give credit to NBC News. Talked about last week how some different national media outlets have been talking about how Minnesota could be the next state to go red. Well, got to give NBC News some credit as they point out that probably won't happen simply because the Twin Cities metro area is growing by 9%, while the rest of Minnesota, including rural areas, is just growing by 3%, which is a really key thing to point out, as I brought up. It's all about the demographics, and while the metro area generally votes Democratic, yeah, that area is growing faster than other areas of the state. All right, we'll take a break and come on back with more here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Stay tuned. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here back on the Wednesday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, tomorrow, the Stonewall DFL has a big celebration taking place as they are going to be celebrating their 40th anniversary of being in existence. If you're not familiar, the Stonewall DFL is the advocacy arm of the DFL, which helps people with LGBTQ issues. And joining us now to talk about that 40th anniversary celebration is Sam Doten. He is the chair of the Stonewall DFL. Hey, Sam, how you doing today?
Hi, Brett. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Stonewall DFL works for a safe and equitable Minnesota by electing lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and allied Democrats to public office in Minnesota, and the party offices in the Minnesota DFL. So that's a little bit of a rundown on what you guys do. But
yep.
Tell us a little bit more about the Stonewall DFL, the history, how you guys got started, and what issues you kind of advocate for.
Yeah, so like you said, we're celebrating 40 years. We were founded in 1980. And, you know, of course, advocacy didn't begin there in 1980, and the folks who created Stonewall had known each other and had been advocating really at the vanguard of LGBTQ issues in the years following the Stonewall riots in 1969. So those years were important years in the creation of the LGBTQ movement in Minnesota, and we saw some specific things like the first gay marriage, although was later overturned, but the first gay marriage in Minnesota. And anyway, Stonewall was founded in 1980, and since then, although the organization, the caucus, has looked differently over the years, we've been the longest still existing organization working on LGBTQ equity in policy and politics, operating for 40 years continuously. So one of the big things we do is we endorse candidates for public office. And once we endorse them, we have a screening process, we have a written questionnaire. We really make sure that they understand the needs and concerns of the LGBTQ community. And then we work with them to get them elected so that we can send them to the legislature or send them to the governor's mansion or wherever and hold them accountable to standing up for our community, especially in those critical moments where Republicans choose to turn our lives and our identities into political issues and try to make us the target of harassment and hatred and the policy that comes out of that in order to score political points.
Yeah, absolutely. And you brought up that good example back in 2012 when, of course, you were instrumental in helping to defeat that marriage amendment, or I should say anti-marriage amendment, that was put on
right.
the ballot on the Minnesota elections back in 2012. I got to ask you this. Do other states have similar types of arms within their Democratic parties, similar to like the Stonewall DFL? Or talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you sure bet they do. So we were originally known as the LGBT and Friends Caucus, but we've been Stonewall since the 90s, mm-hmm. And there are similar LGBTQ caucuses or clubs across the country and across the Democratic Party. And there was at one time a national Stonewall Democrats organization as well. So what the structure in different states looks different. In Minnesota, we have statewide caucuses. Other areas of the country tend to have more of their local or county unit-based LGBTQ organizations. Stonewall clubs in general, they exist in most states of the country.
And you guys have your 40th anniversary celebration coming up tomorrow. And man, 40 years. So you guys were started back in 1980. And that was certainly a period where LGBTQ issues were, well, not very popular among the general public. So it's great you've been around for 40 years. So talk about what people can expect tomorrow at the event. I believe it takes place from 7 until 8:15 p.m. via Zoom.
Yep, it'll be 7 to 8:15 p.m. Folks who want to register can go to our website, mnstonewalldsl.org, and this is a free event. And we're super excited to welcome Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin. She's going to be our headline speaker. And Tammy Baldwin, she's the first out LGBTQ U.S. senator in this country's history. And she wasn't the first out LGBTQ person in the U.S. House of Representatives, but she was the first one who was out before being elected to office. So everyone before her came out after they're elected, presumed to be straight. So she's been breaking barriers for her entire career, starting in Dane County in Wisconsin up to the United States Senate. And so we're really excited to welcome her. We're also excited to welcome Senator Scott Dibble, who serves in the Minnesota Senate. And he's been a longtime senator, really leading on issues affecting the LGBTQ community, but really all communities. And he's an extraordinary leader, in my opinion, who, you know, he's the only gay, out gay member of the Minnesota Senate. But that's not all he is as a senator. He's one of the leaders on transportation within the Democratic caucus. And just overall with his experience, an exceptional leader. So we're excited to welcome Senators Baldwin and Dibble and some other leaders as well. Councilmember Mitra Jalali from St. Paul, Aaron McQuaid, who ran for lieutenant governor and used to serve in the Minnesota House, and Heather Keeler. She is a candidate, member of our community. She's an indigenous woman running for the Minnesota House up in District 4A in Moorhead. So we're really excited to welcome these excellent speakers. In addition to the speakers, we'll have a program or a little bit of the history of Stonewall DFL, not too long, but just a couple minutes so folks can really understand where we've been over these 40 years. And then finally, we'll be awarding the Rick Stafford and the Alan Speer Awards. These are two awards that Stonewall gives out, and they'll be going to Noah McCourt and Mara Glubka, two fantastic advocates and members of the LGBTQ community who will be honoring tomorrow evening.
So how can people go about registering and making sure they're able to attend the event tomorrow? Again, it's tomorrow from 7 until 8:15 via Zoom.
Yep. Just go to our website, mnstonewalldsl.org. Right at the top, you'll see a link to register for the event. And then you can make a donation if you wish, or you can just hit free admission. Once you hit that, you'll get set up with the Zoom link. You just enter your email, hit enter, and you'll be sent the link to join it via Zoom. And we'll also be live streaming it on our Facebook page. But for the best experience, it'll, of course, be through Zoom.
Yeah, I would agree as well. So several different ways that people can go and attend virtually that 40th anniversary of the Stonewall DFL. A couple more topics I want to talk about with you here, Sam. And one is, I'm sure, something you guys have as a big goal, which is trying to get the DFL to control the state Senate. And if that does happen this fall, what types of pro-LGBTQ legislation could be passed with a change in the Minnesota legislature? Or what types of legislation would you guys like to see passed?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked. The Republican-controlled Minnesota Senate has been the biggest barrier to making progress on basically every issue in Minnesota for the past couple of years. So when we turn the Minnesota Senate blue, when it's the DFL-controlled chamber, we're not just looking to turn it Democrat and then expect everything to get better. We know that we need to fill the ranks of Democrats with progressive leaders who won't view our community as something that they can ignore as convenient or gets in the way of them maybe cutting a deal with Republicans but leaves us behind. So once we win the Senate, one of the biggest priorities, and this is the front of mind a lot of folks at the legislature, is to ban conversion therapy. Representative Hunter Cantrell in previous sessions, not this year, but the year before everything blew up with COVID, was carrying the conversion therapy bill and passed it through the Minnesota House. So we need a Democrat Senate to be able to pass that bill, and we know that Governor Walz will sign it. But there are other issues as well, things that aren't LGBTQ issues per se, but certainly affect our community and are really important and are definitely at the front of our priorities as a caucus. Some of those issues include criminal justice reform and really deep, substantial reforms and changing the structure of policing in Minnesota. The trans women of color in particular have, just across the board, horrendous experiences when they encounter the criminal justice system. One of the questions that we ask our candidates applying for our endorsement is essentially to address the issues of the experiences of trans folks when they're incarcerated. And we get a lot of great answers about we should, you know, have better training for guards, and we should ensure there's reporting and follow-up and ombudspersons and these great things. But there was one answer that a candidate gave that really stuck out, and it just strikes to the core of what we need to change, is we can start by incarcerating less people, mm-hmm. or fewer people. If we have fewer people incarcerated, we have fewer trans folks who will always be disproportionately targeted by a racist system that will get swept up into it. So these are the kind of conversations that we're trying to have with our with these folks that we endorse, because we don't just want to have a Democratic majority and then expect them to get it done. We need to hold them accountable as constituents, as members of the community who have organized together politically to make our needs known. So we have criminal justice, we have conversion therapy, and then one of the issues as well is that will be addressed is if we have a Democratic Senate and if we can expand the Democratic majority in the House, is so we can finally pass a bonding bill. And that's going to go a long way toward housing in Minnesota. We have hundreds of millions of dollars of projects that will go towards making housing more affordable, but truly affordable, not just that weird area median income formula, which doesn't work for most people.
Right.
And if we can get some real affordable housing built, especially for senior folk, we're going to, I mean, this is a crisis that affects everyone. It doesn't just stay within one city's boundaries or within the lines of a county. And housing is so important for the LGBTQ community, but it's really important, especially for older LGBTQ folks, for them to know that they're going to be able to have housing that's welcoming, that's supportive, and that's safe for them.
And going back to a few other issues that you highlighted that I'm glad you did, and one has to do with the fact that, as you brought up, there are a lot of transgender women of color who have very negative experiences with the police, and it's something that people don't often think about, but I have a couple of friends that have talked about this for a while, so I'm glad you brought that up, because that's very, very important and something that people don't often think of when we talk about police reform and other areas like that.
And I should say, you know, our name, Stonewall, DFL, the name Stonewall comes from the Stonewall Riots and the Stonewall Inn, which was a site of a police raid where the New York Police Department had repeatedly come in and they would shake down the place, they'd arrest everyone that they could. There was just routine harassment of queer and trans and homeless folks who hung together for safety. And it was their persistent harassment. It was the persistent harassment of the police against our community. And one night we said, we're not going to take it anymore. Someone threw a bottle. Our punches were thrown and we fought back and we rioted against the police. And it lasted a week, in the area around the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village in New York City. And it was that moment that was a catalyzing moment for a movement across the country and the world. And it's still remembered today, and we're named after it. And it's important for us as a caucus of the DFL party well, we are an organization that has assimilated or in some ways we're like mainstreamed, right, because we're integrated directly into a political party. But that this is our origin. It was revolt against violence inflicted on us, and we fought back. And so that's the origin and the history and why we need to remember today that LGBTQ people of all races, but disproportionately people of color, are treated with disproportionately treated with violence and arbitrary use of force by our police. So that's the connection, and it's something that's incumbent upon those of us in the queer community, especially those of us that are white, to show up and be in solidarity on that issue, because it's our issue too. And if folks aren't fighting police brutality and violence and discrimination and profiling on every front, then we're doing all of ourselves a disservice. It's an issue that affects all of us.
Any races or candidates that you'd like to highlight? As you brought up earlier in the interview, you talked about how your group has endorsed a number of candidates for some different races that are taking place in the fall of 2020. Yep. Any specific ones that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah. So, well, we've endorsed 47 candidates total, all the way from U.S. Senate down to school board. But I want to mention a couple of folks who are running for the Minnesota Senate, because these folks, it is through them that we will win a DFL Senate majority and a Senate majority that's filled with progressives. So I want to highlight Lindsay Port. She's running down in Senate District 56. That district is currently held by a Republican named Dan Hall. He won by a couple points last time they were up in 2016, but this is a great opportunity to pick up the seat. Dan Hall is an awful legislator, and he's made a point to align himself with anti-queer and anti-trans propagandists. And so that's a priority seat for us. Lindsay is running. It's in the South Metro area. Senate District 56 covers Burnsville, Savage, and I think some of Egan as well.
Mm-hmm.
Another candidate I want to highlight is Alita Borod. She's running in Senate District 26, which is like the half of Rochester and some of the surrounding rural areas and communities. And she's also a fantastic progressive. She's running against the incumbent Carla Nelson, who has tried to pretend to be moderate in some circumstances in the Minnesota Senate, but she votes in lockstep with her party. She doesn't stand up for folks, and we've learned that moderate Republicans, when they vote and talk and do evering that the extreme right-wing Republicans are doing, we're going to hold them accountable for what they're doing and not just what they say. So that's another priority seat in Rochester, Senate District 26, Alita Borod.
And you can find a full list of all of those over at mnstonewalldfl.org to see which candidates have been endorsed by the group this year. And also, again, one more reminder that you can check out the 40th anniversary celebration of the Stonewall DFL. That takes place tomorrow, 7 p.m. You can register over at mnstonewalldfl.org, mnstonewalldfl.org, as that event will take place virtually. We've been speaking with Sam Doten. He is the chair of the Stonewall DFL, chatting with us for the last few minutes about some different issues that are important to the Stonewall DFL. And Sam, really appreciate the time today.
Thanks so much for having me, Brett.
All right, and that's just about going to wrap things up for today on the show. A reminder, we got our presidential debate watching party coming up on Tuesday, September 29th. That will be at Crooner's Supper Club off of Moore Lake and Highway 65 in the North Metro. Love to see you out there. It will be socially distanced, and we'll be doing it in a very safe manner, as Crooner's has been hosting outdoor concerts all summer long, so they definitely will make sure everyone stays safe. Those tables that you'll be sitting at to watch the debate will be socially distanced, and we'd love to see you out there for that Biden versus Trump debate coming up September 29th. You have to order those tickets ahead of time, though, and you can do so over at am950radio.com. That's am950radio.com. Stay tuned. We got Matt McNeil coming up next.